contract that we have been operating under is void. So that causes us now to reassess things.
A judge says the legislative lease in downtown Anchorage is invalid. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, legislative leaders react to a request from Governor Walker to solve the state's budget crisis.
Well, I appreciate the governor writing a letter to us, and we have an opportunity to talk to the governor. We speak to him quite often.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
An Alaska judge ruled today the legislature's lease of the controversial Legislative Information Office in downtown Anchorage is illegal. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the court's decision voids the contract for renting the LIO building, but doesn't spell out what's next.
The ruling from Superior Court Judge Patrick McKay says there were flaws in the way that lawmakers entered into the current lease. The crux of the decision rests on the word extension and whether a fivefold increase in the price of rent after more than $7 million in renovations could be considered an extension of a decade-old lease. According to the judge, by treating the lease as an extension, lawmakers didn't open it up to a competitive bidding process, which it deserved. Pointing to a dramatic remodeling alongside a substantial increase in costs, McKay writes, "A court finding that this leasing scheme could be sole-sourced would eviscerate the competitive principles of the state procurement code." Speaking to members of the press in Juneau, Legislative Council Chair Gary Stevens, Republican from Kodiak, said the decision means the state can no longer make good on the current lease agreement.
The contract that we have been operating under is void. So that causes us now to reassess things, to figure out where we're going and what we're going to do. It doesn't change a lot of things, but it does change some things.
Stephen says the legislature has to decide whether they'll move to the state-owned Atwood building or seek to buy the LIO building outright from its owners. A recent report from the Navigant Consulting Group obtained by the Alaska Dispatch News identifies different financial scenarios for the state to consider, including a competitive sale price around $36 million.
What we're looking at right now, and I should say, we're not trying to harm the owner at all. That's not the goal here. The goal is to find the right price. And it depends on what he's willing to sell the building for.
As of Thursday afternoon, Amy Slinker, a spokesperson for the building's owners, had a short emailed statement that read only, "We are reading through the decision and analyzing next steps." Recently, the owners have said they're willing to sell the building, but say the price would need to be closer to $37 million to not suffer a loss. Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker chaired the legislative council when the lease was negotiated. Hawker's currently in Anchorage undergoing treatment for cancer, but in a written statement released Thursday, he said the legislative council acted in good faith. Clearly, he goes on, a lower court judge has found otherwise, adding that he has no further comment. The McKay ruling is written anticipating a possible appeal in the case, but Stevens says the state is unlikely to go that route.
We're still in the same place we've always been, but it's moved us forward to a position where we need to make a decision. And so we're going to try and call a meeting, if we can arrange it on Tuesday, of Ledge Council and hear from all of our attorneys, hear from all our counsel, hear from everyone, and including the owner if he chooses to be here, and talk about where we go from here.
The case is a victory for Anchorage attorney Jim Gottstein, who brought the suit against the building's owners and the state. Gottstein has long insisted there were numerous problems with the way the lease was handled. He says he's glad the Superior Court agrees.
The main objective was just to get the lease declared illegal, which it has, and so I'd be happy for the case to be over.
The legislature will continue paying for its lease through July. With help from Andrew Kitchenman and Rachel Waldholtz, I'm Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage.
Governor Bill Walker says the legislature must agree to a complete and sustainable solution to the state's fiscal problem this year. In a letter to legislators Walker sent yesterday, he says continuing to draw on reserves without a solid plan to stop doing so is unacceptable. His own budget plan would draw on reserves over the next two budget years before reaching balance in 2019. The letter received a cool reception from the Republican-led House majority. Anchorage Republican Representative Charisse Millette says legislators know that Walker can call a special session.
I think if you take a look at what we're doing in the House, the letter was probably unnecessary. We are working towards it. We are fully aware. We hear from our constituents every day the impact that the budget is having and the projected price of oil has on our economy. We're fully aware of that. So while I appreciate the governor writing a letter to us, I mean, we have an opportunity to talk to the governor. We speak to him quite often.
Walker says the deeper the state draws on reserves, the less money it will have to draw on in the future. And he points out it would drive down the state's credit rating. He says this will slow investment and cause the state's economy to spiral down. The governor says the state must cut spending, restructure permanent fund earnings and dividends, and introduce a broad-based tax. And he says the permanent fund changes must be based on rules that produce a stable amount of revenue and protect the fund. Walker has proposed an income tax, but legislative leaders have resisted that step. Some lawmakers would prefer a statewide sales tax, but Walker didn't propose one. Governor Walker says the legislature can accomplish a sustainable budget without having a special session. He left unsaid the possibility that he will call them into session if they don't meet his requirements. It will be months before a Golden Valley Electric Association coal-fired power plant comes back online. The plant, one of two Golden Valley operates in Healy, has been down since a coal dust explosion on March 3rd. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the incident is similar to others that occurred during initial testing of the recently restarted power plant.
Golden Valley Electric Association Vice President of Power Supply, Lynn Thompson, says the utility is still in the early stages of reviewing the March 3rd explosion at the Healy 2 coal-fired power plant.
We believe that it's going to be a combination of events from probably equipment failure and instrument failure that led to this.
The explosion happened within the plant's coal pulverization and transport facility, and Thompson says at least one major component needs to be replaced.
The mill exhauster fan. That will be about 14 weeks for delivery to Healy.
Thompson says a repair cost estimate is not yet available. The $300 million Healy 2 power plant was built with state and federal support to test new coal-burning technology, but it failed startup testing in 1999 and sat dormant during a prolonged legal dispute until Golden Valley purchased it from the state in 2013 for $44 million. The plant has since undergone major renovation. Thompson says the $190 million project includes work on the coal pulverization and transport facility.
We've added additional safeguard equipment to see that these events don't happen.
It sounds like they're going to have to resolve this coal feeder problem.
Brian Littmans is an attorney with Trustees for Alaska, which successfully pushed for updated emissions controls at both of GVEA's Healy coal-fired power plants. Littman says the March 3rd explosion inspired him to review similar past problems at the Healy 2 plant.
Back in 1999, GVEA did not want the facility. They were very concerned, given all of the problems in the 90-day test period, including two major explosions in the coal feeder zone.
GVEA purchased Healy 2 to help stabilize electric rates by relying more on low-cost coal from the Yucabeli mine in Healy. Littman says the recurring coal pulverization and transport system problems raise concerns about cost savings potential.
At what point do you stop sinking good money after bad? Those are important questions for GVEA, and the ratepayers should know what it's going to take to keep this facility online.
Golden Valley will attempt to answer those questions, according to the utility's Thompson.
We have a forensic engineering team coming in to look at the problems that we experienced this time, and so we will do a very thorough evaluation. evaluation of the equipment and if we need to change procedures or add additional equipment to that system.
Meanwhile, Thompson says a three-month shutdown scheduled for this summer for installation of new emissions controls has been moved up
to try to take advantage of this time that we're going to be offline.
GVEA's other Healy coal-fired power plant continues to operate. Thompson says lost power output from Healy 2 represents about 30% of GVEA's load and is being compensated for with electricity purchased over the intertie and generated at a Golden Valley oil-fired power plant in North Pole. In Fairbanks, Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating a 70-year-old basketball tournament in Juneau and the journey it used to require.
It was cold, frightening, and you swore up and down you'd never do it again. You had to love basketball to travel on those boats.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know that Pick, Click, Give helps over 600 nonprofits across Alaska? Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $13 million to organizations benefiting everything from our youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive in Alaska. A small part of your PFD can make a big impact when you Pick, Click, Give. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation and Pick, Click, Give.
In the last few years, the issue of sexual assault has been a major focus for universities around the nation. The University of Alaska Fairbanks is no exception. University officials recently visited UAF's Northwest Campus in Nome to discuss the issue. KNOM's Emily Russell reports.
To spark discussion on the issue of sexual assault, UAF's Northwest Campus recently screened the documentary The Hunting Ground. The film opens with a rolling orchestral soundtrack that calls to mind university quads and collegiate culture. In the opening sequence, home video shows students react to hearing they've been accepted to their top choice schools. Most of the students are young women, and most of the schools are big-name universities like Notre Dame or Harvard. It's inspiring, but not at all familiar. In Nome, university culture couldn't be more different. UAF's Northwest Campus is a community college that mainly serves non-traditional students. It offers mostly one-credit courses like cusbuck sewing and caribou hide tanning. UAF's interim chancellor, Mike Powers, made the trip from Fairbanks to screen the film. After the closing credits, he opened the room up for public discussion.
What can we do to help support the community, the Northwest Campus, on prevention, on how large an issue is it, on anything we should be aware of?
But the room remained silent. The issue of sexual assault is huge in Alaska. 37% of women in Alaska have been sexually assaulted in their lifetime. That's according to the Alaska Victimization Survey conducted by UAA's Justice Center. In the Nome Census area, from Shishmaref over to Savoonga and down to Stebbins, 31% of women are victims of sexual assault. Mae Marsh is UAF's Title IX coordinator.
If the university can't do something to change this mindset, who can?
Marsh says the university can encourage a stronger stance against sexual assault.
If you come to the university and there's a standard that says this is not acceptable behavior, and if you demonstrate this type of behavior, you will be expelled from our community or you will be suspended. And so it sets a new standard.
But the push for the university to lead the way doesn't quite translate at UAF's Northwest Campus in Nome. Its transient and non-traditional student body makes sweeping changes harder to carry out. Bob Metcalf, the director of UAF's Northwest Campus, says the campus is following in the footsteps of the community.
They're ahead of the campus with Green Dot and equity and social justice. So we see our role as supporting them.
Green Dot is just one of the ways the community is confronting sexual assault. The statewide initiative encourages people to speak out against violence. It's already been introduced at Nome Public Schools. Local parent Dana Handlin has two kids in college. She says talking about sexual assault before kids leave for college is a good thing.
You know, most kids grow up with all the kids they go to school with are almost siblings by the time they graduate.
Despite having both kids out of the house, Handlin was at the screening of The Hunting Ground to educate herself. She says for kids who grew up in bush communities, the transition to college can be traumatic.
Rural communities need to start this much sooner than just, okay, let's make sure you watch this as orientation in college, because they're already bombarded with, how am I going to find my class? Where is this building?
UAF's interim chancellor Mike Powers and Title IX coordinator Mae Marsh offered updates and answered questions for locals in the audience like Handeland. But there was a clear disconnect, the differences between battles being fought on campus in Fairbanks and throughout the community in Nome highlighted their different priorities. Without an action plan in place, UAF officials boarded a plane out of Nome that same evening, leaving the community to continue its uphill battle against sexual assault. I'm Emily Russell in Nome.
The Department of Fish and Game plans to trap a flock of birds not native to Alaska that is trying to move into the Homer area. The agency says starlings could cause big problems for humans and other birds native to the region. They want to get rid of the flock before its numbers grow. KBBI's Quinton Chandler has more.
The trap sits near the entrance of Ben Walters Park near the northwest shore of Beluga Lake. It looks like a chicken run. It's fenced in with 1-inch chicken wire so smaller animals that Fish and Game doesn't want to capture can easily get out if they wander inside.
And then in the center of it, in the middle, it has a slope design with the roof coming down. And then large slots about an inch and a quarter, inch and a half in diameter, just big enough for a starling to get through to get down to a bait tray in the center of the trap.
Jason Harriman, assistant area management biologist with Fish and Game, says starlings are an invasive species from Europe. They have a unique migration story, to say the least. The story goes they were given a foothold in the U.S. in the late 1800s when Shakespeare fans released a number of the birds in New York City. Their goal was apparently to bring every bird mentioned in Shakespeare's work to the country. But as far as Harriman knows, starlings have never lived in the Homer area. He says starlings are cavity nesters, and they could force other birds out of prime nesting spots.
Such as chickadees, woodpeckers, nuthatches. And then they also have been known to be a problem as far as crop degradation goes with airports. Here we are close to the air pond and the airfield here in Homer, and large flocks of these have been known to be quite problematic around airfields before.
Fish and Game wants to trap the birds that are here before their numbers grow. Harriman says once a strong population is established, it will be much harder.
We have pigeons out on the spit. You know, that's a species that previous biologists tried to get rid of when they first showed up in town and weren't necessarily successful at, and they have become established and are a nuisance problem we get complaints about every year.
Harriman says so far he's only seen one flock of starlings in the area, and it had between 35 and 40 birds. He says other traps the same size as Fish and Game's have held up to 100 birds at a time. He checks the trap every morning to make sure it's not damaged and, of course, to see if he's caught anything.
I'm unsure about that. Yesterday morning when I went and checked the trap had been tampered with. The lid had been ripped off and some of the wire pulled back. The screws were actually unscrewed, so it looks like it was a human who probably let something out of the trap.
Harriman says trap tampering can be an issue no matter what animal is being targeted. He says Fish and Game clearly labels their traps to discourage people from bothering them.
So that folks know that it's, you know, an official effort. It's not just some individual out to do something nefariously. But yeah, it's not uncommon.
The opening at the top of the trap is sized specifically for starlings, but there is a chance for other animals to get locked in. If that happens, Harriman says he'll let them out. If a starling wanders into the trap, he plans to leave it there in hopes it will call out to the rest of the flock and lure more of the birds inside. If the trap works, Harriman says the birds captured will be euthanized. In Homer, I'm Quinton Chandler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Skagway residents could be sipping locally crafted spirits in the near future. Two entrepreneurs have applied for a distillery liquor license in Skagway. Their applications are part of a growing craft distillery market in Alaska. But as KHNS's Emily Files reports, there can only be one distillery in the gateway to the Klondike.
That's the sound of a Made in Haines cocktail being stirred at the Port Chilkoot Distillery. It could be joined by another Upper Lynn Canal distillery in the next couple years.
Any objection to this request?
No objection.
Two distillery liquor licenses have come before the Skagway Assembly in the past 6 months. The first, in November, was from Gary Hager for a distillery called Skagway Spirits. The second, which came before the Assembly last week, is from Dan and Christine Turner for a distillery dubbed Alaska Stillman.
There's only one distillery license allowed in Skagway.
Cynthia Franklin is director of the Alaska Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. She says only one distillery is allowed per 3,000 people in Alaskan towns and cities. So why are there two applications for Skagway?
Should he not be able to produce, that we're waiting to step in.
Joel Probst is the project manager for Alaska Stillman. He says the Turners know there's only one distillery allowed in Skagway, but they want to be next in line if Hager's Skagway Spirits license doesn't go through.
The vision is to get 4 to 5 full-time people working, the hopes, and having a year-round operation there with the ability to export a commodity that's both flavorful, if you will, and also appealing to a broader audience.
Hager did not respond to requests for comment by deadline for this report. But according to Franklin, it looks like his Skagway Spirits venture is on track to get final license approval. The Alcohol Control Board is scheduled to make a final decision on Skagway Spirits license at its April 26th meeting.
This really is first come, first serve. Skagway applied for the license. If they meet the requirements, which they have every indication that they will, you know, the board gives that person the license. You know, the board doesn't have the authority to deny the license because there's someone else coming up behind them that says, hey, we have a better idea for a distillery, and Skagway can only have one.
Franklin says back when state regulations around liquor licenses were established, they couldn't have foreseen the sea change in the alcohol market that's happened in the past decade or so.
You've had this rise of craft breweries, craft distilleries, brew pubs. When our rules were written in 1980, we had no manufacturing of alcohol in Alaska. We imported all of our alcohol.
There's currently 5 operating distillery licenses in Alaska, and it looks like it's going to at least double over the next year.
Heather Shade owns Port Chilkoot Distillery and leads the Distillers Guild of Alaska. She says distillery license applications have cropped up across the state, not just in Skagway, but Juneau, Fairbanks, Homer.
I think it's a good trend. The micro distilling industry has the potential to create good local manufacturing jobs and to support partner industries such as Alaska agriculture and tourism. So I see it as a good thing that our state can encourage and tap into.
The question of which business will get Skagway's only distillery license could be answered by the end of April. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Before statehood and before the Alaska Marine Highway System, there was the gold medal basketball tournament in Juneau. This year, the event turned 70. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
A group of elders sit along Juneau Douglas High School's gym wall. Their eyes are fixed on the players as they warm up before the game. Yakutat versus Klukwan. 75-year-old Charlie Williams is one of them. He lives in Juneau now, but he's been coming to gold medal since the 1940s. And naturally, he's rooting for his home team.
All the good-looking people come from Klukwan because they drink that Chilkat water. 21 miles where you want to drink your water.
The tournament started back in 1947, a year after another basketball institution, the NBA. Shorts were shorter, the three-point line didn't exist, and traveling to Juneau meant making a special trip. William says his parents laid it out like this. If he wanted to go to gold medal, he'd have to make better grades than his siblings.
Well, there's probably about 8 of us kids then, you know, competing. just fortunate I just studied a little harder and we had to do our chores. It wasn't easy.
Chopping and carrying heavy wood is one of those chores he remembers being especially tough.
We really didn't have that much, and it was really great to come down here to the old gym down there in Fifth Street.
Gold Medal started as a fundraiser for the Boy Scouts. Although villages dominate the brackets now, the first teams to compete were Juneau, Petersburg, Ketchikan, and Skagway. Petersburg took home the win that first year.
The first Philly team to enter was Cake, AMP, 1949.
That's Gil Truitt, a former gold medal player, coach, referee, and all-around wealth of information on the topic. He couldn't be at the tournament this year because it came down to attending gold medal or the state high school basketball tournament. The gold medal still holds a special place in his heart. He played in the early years with his high school team in Sitka.
First with Mount Edgecombe, then Sitka A&B, then Sitka Columbia Lumber.
In those days, basketball was big in Sitka, and had been for a while. One of Sitka's first teams was started in 1914 by a branch of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. Truitt says pre-internet, pre-ESPN, he looked up to Herb Diedrichsen, a local player. So when Truitt was able to travel for the tournament with his high school team, he came over on a 14-hour-long voyage to Juneau on a fishing vessel.
It was cold, frightening, scary, and you swore up and down you'd never do it again. And I'm sure a lot of guys prayed. You had to love basketball to travel on those boats.
The boat would also be the team's sleeping quarters during the week. And arriving in Juneau back in that day, Truitt says the players, Alaska Natives, didn't always receive the warmest welcome. But over the years,
the people were able to see that the native teams like Sitka A&B and Metlakatla, they were so outstanding and colorful, and the pleasure to watch the people forgot about the color. And I think basketball helped break down those prejudices that we witnessed.
Now the teams travel to gold medal by ferry and air. From Hoonah, Cake, Craig, Haines, Wrangell, Heidelberg, Kluckwan, Yakutat, and Metlakatla. Some things about the tournament have changed. NCAA-certified refs are brought in from down south to make sure there's no local bias. And women-led teams are tearing up the courts.
Little baby on
the hip. Yeah, he's 5 months old. His first gold medal.
This is Haines player Jamie Bentley's first gold medal, too. And she says so far, the community excitement for the tournament has made an impression.
I mean, you see family, kids running around. The families are all enjoying this event together. It's really special. It's very unique to Southeast Alaska, and I love it.
For Charlie Williams, who's sitting courtside and gone to decades of games, it's about the same thing.
That's why I come to the gold medal. Friends, right here.
And of course, the basketball. Williams' team, Kluckwan, won its game that day. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Russell in Nome, Quentin Chandler in Homer, and Emily Files in Haines. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Did you know that Pick, Click, Give helps over 600 nonprofits across Alaska? Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $13 million to organizations benefiting everything from our youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive in Alaska. A small part of your PFD can make a big impact when you Pick, Click, Give. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation and Pick, Click, Give.
The Elder Mentor Program is seeking low-income seniors age 55 or older who have a passion for children and for sharing cultural values. Eligibility information at ruralcap.com. This message sponsored by Rural Alaska Community Action Program, Inc.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.